Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad to have you with us this morning. From Freddie Gray in Baltimore to Laquan McDonald in Chicago, tensions between police and communities of color continue to be at a fever pitch. Two issues in particular are receiving increased attention. Number one, transparency by police and other government officials when alleged acts of police misconduct occur. And number two, the consequences of the so-called war on drugs, which has led to huge rates of arrests and incarceration. Now, a conversation with two people who have thought a lot about the policing issues that cities, suburbs, and rural areas around the nation are struggling with. Jamie Calvin joins us by phone from Chicago. He's a writer and the executive director of the Invisible Institute, which has been instrumental in making internal police documents about police misconduct cases available to the public, including making public the police dash cam video and autopsy report in the Laquan McDonald case. Welcome, Mr. Calvin.
Good to be with you.
And Neil Franklin also joins us by phone from San Francisco. He's the executive director of LEAP, L-E-A-P, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. He was undercover in the early 1980s and was also the commanding officer of drug and criminal enforcement on the Eastern Shore. He grew up in Reservoir Hill here in Baltimore and worked for a while in Baltimore City as the head of training for the Baltimore City Police Department. Mr. Franklin, thank you for your time as well.
Thanks for having me.
Jamie Calvin, obviously here in Baltimore, we're thinking a lot about police misconduct and related issues. The first of six trials in the death of Freddie Gray is in its fifth day as we speak. In Chicago last month, your organization, the Invisible Institute, released a database of more than 56,000 Chicago police misconduct complaints records that involve more than 8,500 Chicago police officers. This database is on the web. It's called the Citizens Police Data Project. Give us a quick summary of how this came to be put together.
So it's the product of almost a decade of litigation and public advocacy that culminated in March 2014 with an appellate court decision in Illinois that held that police misconduct files are public information. And having won that decision, we were able to access the information that you made reference to and have put a lot of energy into trying to make it really legible and useful for citizens, for journalists, for civil rights lawyers.
It's been posted online for a month or so now. What have you learned as you look at this data?
You know, I think what the data, so you can learn things about individual officers, about their complaint histories. And again, most recently in the case of Laquan McDonald, there something happens, there's a criminal prosecution of an officer, and it becomes apparent that there were multiple occasions provided by citizen complaints of misconduct to have intervened earlier, and no action was taken. More generally, the database provides a kind of portrait of impunity, really. It's just extraordinarily unlikely, on the basis of the city's own statistics and data, that that abuse will be identified, seriously investigated, and disciplined. So what it really demonstrates is the kind of space that exists, the impunity that exists for that small but not insignificant subset of officers who are disposed to be abusive, whatever form, racist, corrupt, brutal. They know that they will be unlikely ever to be punished in any significant way, and the database really reflects that reality.
And the database, does it include all of the complaints that were registered? Does it include any information about the disposition of those complaints? In other words, were some of them dismissed?
Yeah, it does. So what we have are the allegation, the officer demographic information about the officer, demographic information about the victim, and the ultimate disposition of the complaint. And I don't have the figures in front of me as we speak, but a very, very high number of complaints, well over 90% of complaints, are found to be not sustained, which is a kind of shrug of the shoulders. We couldn't even come to a determination. Mm-hmm. Of those that are sustained, an infinitesimal number lead to any kind of meaningful punishment. So, as I say, this is a system that really is dedicated to kind of not knowing things that the police department is capable of knowing, and the city is capable of knowing about fundamental human rights abuses. There is no, we have depositions from city officials and police department officials in which they have been candid about the fact that they do no pattern analysis with this, you know, really precious information. Mm-hmm. So they don't look at high numbers of complaints of individual officers, the pattern of particular allegations, groups of officers working together. You know, imagine a corporation that didn't do that kind of quality control if it had this sort of feedback from its customers.
As we finish up with this part of our discussion today, Mr. Calvin, the city of Chicago over the last 10 years, which is the period of time encompassed in your study, has paid, according to some reports, particularly by the Better Government Association, according to the New Yorker magazine, more than $521 million in settlements with people who've complained about police misconduct. Is that basically the way they've been able to keep this information private for as long as they have?
I think that's part of the machinery. I mean, the figure is $500 million over 10 years in legal awards and settlements. And so part of the machinery, you know, there are other elements in this sort of, you know, machinery of not knowing, not disclosing the realities, are these settlements. And, you know, the numbers are huge. I mean, imagine if $500 million had been devoted to sort of reparations and really meaningful reform in making a more vigorous accountability system.
Sure.
So I think that's something that bears close examination now.
Jamie Calvin is the director of the Invisible Institute, joins us on the phone from Chicago. Neil Franklin is in San Francisco. Thank you, Mr. Franklin, for getting up so bright and early. Tell us a little bit about the organization you head, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Why are you against prohibition of, I assume you're talking about drugs here?
Yeah, absolutely. We're an organization. We were formed in 2002 by two police officers on the East Coast, one a retired lieutenant from New Jersey State Police and another captain from a town in New York State. And the premise here is the prohibition of drugs, some refer to it as the war on drugs, is the one single issue that causes more problems in more areas of the lives of not just the people in the United States, but globally, than any other single issue. So, for instance, the initial goals of the war on drugs was to reduce crime, disease, death, and addiction. Each one of those categories has gotten worse over the past four decades since Nixon coined the phrase back in the 1970s. And we compare it to alcohol prohibition of the 1920s, which only lasted 13 years. And it only lasted 13 years because of the violence that was generated from the sale and manufacture and transportation of illicit booze. And, you know, organized crime and criminals like Al Capone, speaking about Chicago, from Chicago, you know, tried to corner the market, and doing so, they used guns to manage that illicit, well, bootlegging industry. And we see the very same thing today with drive-by shootings and running gun battles, and as young boys try to corner the market share in many of our urban centers, they use guns to do the same thing. So it has increased crime. It goes against public safety, corruption that comes from that, mass incarceration. We imprison more people in the United States than any other country in the world. We're only 5% of the world's population here, but we have almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. Most of those people are imprisoned for drug-related crimes.
Do you make a distinction between certain drugs that, you know, may or may not be legalized? I mean, obviously, there's a movement towards legalizing marijuana, and most folks would point to a big difference between that and legalizing crack cocaine.
Well, it's not really about the drug. I mean, even consider that drugs are potentially dangerous. Let's just make that a given. If they are so problematic and dangerous, the worst thing you can do is turn the market over to criminal organizations to manage within our communities. You first have to realize, and I hope people do, that it's impossible to have a drug-free society. We as people have never been drug-free, and we never will be. So it's about managing drugs within your communities the best way possible to reduce harm to the lowest possible level. And you have to do that through regulation. You can't do that through prohibition. I hope we learned that lesson by now. So that's what it's about. It's about the policy for managing drugs. Not drugs are neither good or bad. You can't have a war against a glass sitting on a table. It's about what makes the glass either dangerous or not dangerous is the environment in which you use it. If you break it and you cut yourself because you're not using it properly, yeah, it's dangerous. But if you use it properly, it's not. It's the same thing with drugs. So this is about policy. It's not about good drugs versus bad drugs. That
right. doesn't make sense. Well, I'm sorry that's all the time we have this morning, but I'm very grateful to both of you for sharing your perspective. Thanks so much. Neil Franklin is formerly with the Maryland State Police and the Baltimore City Police Department. He's now the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Monday night, he'll appear at a forum sponsored by the Open Society Institute. It's called Talking About Addiction, Rethinking the Role of Law Enforcement. He'll be joined on that panel by Leonard Campanello, the Police Chief of Gloucester, Massachusetts. That event begins at 7 o'clock at the 2640 space in Charles Village. Thanks to Jamie Calvin, for joining us from Chicago this morning as well. Coming up, our movie mavens join me in the studio, and later on, we'll share with you the music that will soon become Maryland Morning's new theme song. First, here's Nathan.